Welcome to the AquariMax audio show with Russ and Kelly. We provide information on all kinds of aquarium-related topics.
It's episode 126, recorded August 13th, 2012.
Okay, I hope that worked. Sometimes you push the button and you don't know. But it looks like it's working now.
It looks like it worked.
Okay. Ah, it looks like you accidentally turned the page. And I will fix that. There you go.
Okay. We're off to a fabulous start.
Rip-roaring beginning, ladies and gentlemen. So welcome, AquariMaxers. New and old to AquariMax.
Yes.
The audio show.
As opposed to the movie.
Yeah, or the...
Which this is not.
Plush toy.
The plush toy. Ooh, I want the AquariMax plush toy. Can I have one?
Yes.
What would it even be?
I don't know.
Like, your head plush?
Oh, that's an awful image. I don't even want to do that. Okay, let's get on with the show, shall
we? Would it be a plush word of AquariMax?
That sounds like better than my head. Okay.
Or would it be a fish?
I don't know.
I don't know.
Yeah, let's start the show.
That was an interesting little tangent that we didn't need to take.
Whoa. Okay. So who's on the show today?
Tony and Carlos and Andreka and even us.
Okay, well, Tony and Carlos are in New York, and Andreka is in Oregon, and we're in Utah, right? As far as I remember.
I think so.
Okay, well, let's begin.
Okay, so we're going to start with us, and you have an update for us on the baby bettas?
Yeah, you know, they're 3 weeks old today.
Little things.
So, woohoo, we made
Stick
a little...
Stick them in a bonnet and take pictures.
Yeah, we actually made a little cake out of brine shrimp and tiny little can...
No, we totally didn't.
But they're 3 weeks old today. And you can start to see some of their fin development. I mean, their caudal fins you could see quite early on, but now you can start to see their dorsal and anal fins developing, which is kind of fun and exciting. And they really are eaters.
They are fat.
They're incredibly fat.
Just little round bellies.
Yeah, and I was comparing them to tennis rackets and sort of things in profile. I mean, they get huge.
And kind of look like
I was kind of worried because, you know, fry in general, fish fry, you want them to be rotund. You want them to eat a lot, and you want them to be full. But I was just getting a little worried because I've never seen fry.
They were so full.
Like this. And so I emailed Carlos, and I said, am I overdoing it here? And he said, well, he has heard that, he hasn't seen it, but he has heard that sometimes the bettas can actually eat so much that they will, they're burst, their bellies will burst.
Ow.
But he hasn't seen it happen.
That's so sad.
But he's heard of it.
Do they just not have any shut-off mechanism to tell themselves that they're full?
Well, I'm not sure what it is. I mean, most fry eat a lot, like I was saying, and they get quite rotund, and it's a good thing when you see those little bellies packed full of brine shrimp or microworms or whatever it is. But, I just never seen it to this extreme. And so I asked Carlos, and he didn't seem too worried about it, but he did say that it could happen, you know, it could burst, but what you could do, because I was worried partly that the ones that were eating too much could hurt themselves, but also that the ones that were eating too much could outcompete their younger mm-hmm. brethren. And so Carlos said one thing to do, because I wasn't sure what would be a good practical way to separate them, or if there was one, and Carlos said that you just use, like, critter totes. And you put them inside
them.
The main tank, and you can,
oh.
you can decide whether you want to put the larger fry in there.
Mm-hmm.
Sort of allow the other fish outside of that container to catch up. Or if you want to put the smaller fry in there and add them a little extra food and make sure they get it in that mm-hmm. localized area. So you could do either one.
That makes sense.
And I thought that was a great idea. You know, either way, yep. it could work. And the only downside he mentions is that you have to change the water every day in the little containers.
What, isn't the little container inside the big container?
Yes, it is, but you have to separately change the water in a way. I mean, you have to clean
How
it out.
It?
Separately, because it has a bottom, and
it's
so you need to go in and siphon the gunk out the bottom.
I see.
And, you know, you should clean some of the water out, do a partial water change in the main tank at least every other day, I guess, but...
How often have we been doing it? I thought you were doing it every day.
Just about every day. Just about every day. I think there's been one or two days that I haven't, but no, just about every day since they got old enough to do it.
Okay.
So, anyway, thank you, Carlos, for your help once again. Your continued help. You've been
yes.
helping us every step of the way, including the preliminary planning stages, and it's been awesome, so thank you.
And, okay, we tried a new thing, speaking of the baby bettas, about the brine shrimp, feeding them the brine shrimp, so you want to tell us about that?
Yeah, I thought I'd try decapsulating the brine shrimp cysts.
And explain what that means.
Well, brine shrimp are hatched from cysts. They're basically eggs that are in an advanced stage of development that has been arrested. It's in diapause. So they develop up to a certain point, and then that development stops, and it is ready to be reinitiated with certain cues.
So they start growing, and then it pushes pause.
Yeah, there's sort of a biological pause button, if you will, that can only be pushed with certain cues, such as light, temperature, water, and salt, and so on.
Okay.
Those things. You have those in the right proportions, and you get hatched eggs. Well, the idea is they've discovered that you can remove the hard protective outer covering and just leave a thin membrane. And when you do that, there are a couple of advantages. One, you don't have to worry about any bacteria that are on the outside, because the process of removing the outer shell of the cyst also kills bacteria. Two, you can feed these decapsulated cysts, as they are called, to fish, because they don't have this hard outer shell. And so instead of having to tediously go through some sort of rigmarole to separate the unhatched cysts and the shells of hatched ones from the actual brine shrimp nuclei themselves, you can just dump it all in and let the fish go to town.
Because they're now chewy, they're not crunchy, they're not going to choke on them.
Right, right. There's no danger of them swallowing the cyst, which can be
It's
dangerous.
Just the creamy caramel center.
Something like that, yeah. With removing the crunchy outside.
Yeah.
And except the crunchy and digestible outside.
Mm-hmm.
Another benefit that is sometimes cited is that because the little shrimp themselves don't have to struggle out of the shell,
mm-hmm.
they have more energy reserved for food value, because they're not, you know, using
See,
that energy to get out of the shell.
Fish get more out of the shrimp.
Yeah, more bang for their buck, so to speak. So these are some benefits that are cited, and of course, it's probably a minuscule amount of energy that it takes to get them out of the shell, and so they're still getting a large amount of energy even if you don't decapsulate them. But I think one of the benefits, too, is that you can decapsulate a large number of them, and if you store them in a hypersaline solution, you know, high salt solution,
mm-hmm.
you can keep them in your fridge for a long time and just take out the amount you need to hatch bit by bit. And then you don't need to worry about all the cysts in the meantime.
Hmm.
So day to day, it removes a couple of steps.
If you do a big
batch
at
once. Of course, decapsulating takes a long time, because I'll put some links where I referred to this information, because I read about decapsulation a long time ago, but I had never tried it. But basically, just down the bare bones, you put some eggs in a small amount of water, and you agitate them to get them to hydrate. Just fresh water. It doesn't have to be salt water. Okay. And for about 90 minutes, they need to be agitated. You can just shake them manually or put them in your pocket and walk around or whatever you do.
Wait, they have to be agitated for 90 minutes?
Well, it doesn't have to be constantly 90 minutes, but during those 90 minutes, it needs to be agitated several times. Because some of them will float up to the top and stay there unless you shake it periodically. Remember how I was shaking it? You thought that was amusing?
Yes. Okay, I have to tell you how he was doing this. He shook it up in his hand, you know, first.
And I did that numerous times throughout the 90 minutes.
But then, just to be funny, he stuck it in his back pocket, and every few minutes he'd go into this funny little dance so that his back pocket would be shaking. And we should have filmed it to put it up for the
Well, no, we wouldn't have put it up for that. But
come on!
It was entirely for your benefit.
It was funny! Everybody would love it.
Well, anyway, for 90 minutes you have to do this periodic agitation. Because if you don't, like I said, some will float at the top and just stick there and not hydrate properly. Then after that, you have, in proportion to the amount of water, you put about 3 parts of bleach, household bleach, normal old household bleach, 3 parts of bleach per 1 part water. So it's a really strong bleach solution.
Okay.
And then you agitate that for a short time, not nearly 90 minutes, a very short time, a few minutes. You need to be guided by the color. The color of the cyst will change.
And is this, you're shaking it constantly?
You are shaking
now?
It while you do it, pretty much constantly, yeah.
Okay.
And they need to become kind of orange. And when they do, now, disclaimer here, I do not necessarily endorse the safety of this, but here you go. So don't take our word for it, you know. But look it up and read some other sources on how to do it, too. Anyway, you're supposed to strain the bleach solution. I used a brine shrimp net. I dumped the now decapsulated cysts into a brine shrimp net. dumped white vinegar on them, which is intended to help arrest the action of the bleach, and then rinse them in fresh water. And so I did that. And I would do that in a well-ventilated area if I'm doing it, but I don't take any responsibility. Okay, go ahead.
Bleach, scary. It's not something you would ever put in your fish tank. Why doesn't it kill the brine shrimp?
Because it kills their cyst, doesn't it?
It kills their cyst, but then why does it stop and not go through the membrane? And if it can go through this hard shell, if it can go through this hard shell, why can't it dissolve the membrane?
That is a great question. I'm sure if you left them in there too long, they would. It would, and that's why you have to, rinse it pretty fast when they're orange.
Okay.
But I'm assuming that there's just some property of resistance in there. Maybe the molecule's too big to permeate that membrane right away, or I don't know exactly what it is. But you have a window during which you can just get rid of the cyst part, the outer shell, and the rest of it is intact. So, kind of neat. And then after you've rinsed it out with the fresh water, and you rinse it pretty thoroughly so you don't smell any bleach or anything, and then you put it in your hatching solution just as if they were normal eggs.
Just like normal. Does it take less time for them to hatch?
They say it does. I'm not sure whether it does or not. It didn't seem to be appreciably less time to me, but the nice thing was, when I strained it out, I didn't have a big bunch of, unhatched cysts or just cyst shells to deal with, and I was really excited about that.
It makes it easier to feed them?
Yeah, one thing, though, is when you're hatching them, you need to agitate them a little bit more, because generally you aerate brine shrimp eggs for optimum hatch, but with these you need to do it more. You need more bubbles. You need more. The water needs to move more.
More bubbles for the ones without the cysts.
Because the cyst outer shell seems to make them more buoyant. Mm-hmm. They tend to sink toward the bottom.
Okay.
When they don't have it, and so, in order to keep them in suspension, make sure they're getting aerated properly, you need more bubbles.
Interesting.
You just need more of a trickle when you're doing it the other way, as a minimum. I mean, they generally recommend that you get it going, quite bubbly, but anyway, you need more bubbles.
So you've got a little brine shrimp jetted tub.
Something like that, yeah. Jacuzzi for brine shrimp.
Jacuzzi for brine shrimp, there we go. So that's something to think about when you're hatching brine shrimp for fry, that if you do it in a big enough batch, it might save you some time.
Right, and if you just do it once just for fun, it won't save you any time, but it can be kind of nice not to have to dig through all the cyst shells. Mm-hmm. So I'm thinking of doing a fairly large batch of them next time, so that our kids can more easily hatch them. I wouldn't allow them to do the bleach part. I'm not going to do that myself. But then once they are in the hypersaline solution, maybe I can have them hatch them from that point.
Alrighty, we're going to move on to Tony.
Tony in New York?
Yes. The Tony.
Indeed, the Tony.
He says, as you may recall, I am interested in obtaining assassins in the near future. I'm sure he means assassin snails and not like actual ninjas who are going to come and kill you.
Right.
Yes. And I have heard that it is possible to quarantine snails individually, 6 snails in 6 containers, for example, in order to deny parasites and infection vector. As the theory goes, leaving the snails in solitary confinement for a time will kill off any parasites and make them aquarium safe. Would you please share your thoughts on this? I imagine that this sort of method wouldn't protect against everything, but perhaps it is still worth a try?
Okay, well, this is a great question. I would say it is important, of course, to be wary of parasites and aware that snails are vectors for a wide array of parasites in the world. There are, for example, those large African land snails that that had a population in Hawaii. You remember those?
Oh, yeah.
Big old creatures.
Yeah, they were pretty.
They can actually carry a rather dangerous little creature called the rat lungworm that can cause encephalitis in humans.
Oh, well, that's exciting. Now they're not so pretty.
Well, they're pretty dangerous in that case. I mean, I don't know if they did that in Hawaii or not, but we do know that that is possible. So snails, yes, can carry a variety of parasites. Not that I'm implying that assassin snails carry parasites can be, infectious to humans.
Just snails
but
in general.
Basically, Tony's wondering about parasites that could affect other aquatic creatures in the tank, I'm sure. And, well, the thing is, a lot of parasites, it depends so much on their life cycle and everything. There are so many parasitic life cycles that are very complex, and they have various vectors they have to go through, and they have a certain time window that they have to, go through it. And if you can make sure that they don't get to their next vector during that time window, then they're dead or they're done. You know, you kill them during that period. So the life cycle stage length is important, and how many vectors they have, and so on. And some of them might be terrestrial, and some of them might be aquatic. And there are so many different factors. So I am personally not aware of, I don't know anything about parasites that affect assassin snails and what their life cycles are. I just have to plead ignorance on that. However, it seems likely that if you were to isolate assassin snails for a period of time, if there were parasites, the longer you keep them in isolation, the more likely you are to break any sort of parasite cycle. It does make sense.
Because they just don't have anything to move on to the next stage with.
Right. Now, if it's a parasite that just affects the assassin snails, it might be a different story. But if there are other things going on, then, you know, it seems to make sense. So it may be worth a try. And certainly quarantining them, as long as their water conditions are good, would not hurt them. It'll be a good thing.
Yeah. And I was just, you know, bottom line, I mean, quarantining anything before you put it in the tank is always a good idea.
It's always wise if you have a good place to quarantine it, yeah. So I think that is a good idea. I would probably try it if you're worried about parasites being an issue, so good idea.
Well, before we go on to the next one, let's take our break.
Hello, this is Ken Jones of the Prince of Ponds and Pet Tech Podcasts, and you're listening to one of my favorites, the Aquarimax Show.
Now there are more ways than ever to be a part of Aquarimax. In addition to downloading the podcast on iTunes, you can follow us on Twitter, like our Facebook page, subscribe to our YouTube channel, or call us anytime and leave a phone message at 801-477-0629, or just email us at info@aquarimax.com. And now, back to the Aquarimax Audio Show, the podcast with Icy Nelly.
Okay, we are going to go on to Andreika's questions. She has some questions about moving fish, like when you're relocating.
Okay.
So she wants to know just tips for that and the best ways to do that kind of thing.
Yes, and she mentioned to me on Facebook, Andreika mentioned that she is thinking about moving someplace about an hour away, or they're going to be traveling for about an hour, I believe.
So someplace it is difficult to make multiple trips.
Right. And I have some tips for her because hopefully this will be helpful. Coincidentally, we moved some fish today because it was time for me to go back to work after summer vacation.
Sadness.
And I had a month of summer vacation, which is
beautiful.
Pretty sweet. And so I didn't keep my fish and frogs at work during that period. I had them at home and I had to move them back. And so it was kind of timely to just keep everything fresh in my mind for some things we should mention. So first of all, when you're going to move things, you want to plan it well in advance on the day you're doing it. If it's possible, this is what I would do. Okay? At the site where you're going to be bringing the fish, if at all possible, have a couple of clean buckets full of dechlorinated water that have outgassed.
Already.
So 24 hours before you're going to move the fish, if you can. And I know this is not always possible. But if you can, have a couple of buckets of dechlorinated water there that you can put the fish in, or that you can use to pump back into the tank before you put the fish in it, things like that. And hopefully at a temperature that's very close to what your target temperature is as well. If you can't do that, save some clean water from your tank. Just before you move it, drain a few gallons of water from your tank, depending on the size of your tank. Drain some water from that tank that you can use to put back into your tank. And do that before you catch the fish, because when you're catching the fish, you know, you can kick up detritus from the gravel and stuff and make a mess. And so I would do it first. So, of course, if your heater is in a place where draining some of the water would work, then turn off your heater first. Where draining some of the water would cause a problem, then turn off your heater first and let it sit for a while before you start draining the water. It's important.
So the temperature changes isn't so fast for it.
Right. Otherwise, you can break your heater. So if I were going to do it right now, I would go unplug the heater, and then I'd come back in an hour, and I'd drain a third of the water out into a bucket that I'm going to keep. And it depends on the size of your tank. If it's a 250-gallon tank, you're not going to be able to do
take your whole moving truck.
No, you're not going to take a third of your water. But, you know, if you can. Like, today, the tank is slightly less than 5 gallons, so I took a couple of gallons of water with me.
And it was fun.
That was easy. Okay. Then you catch your fish and put them in containers. Several ways to do it. Of course, you can bag the fish either individually, which, depending on how many fish you have, could be a real pain. Mm-hmm. You could put them in buckets, several buckets, depending on, you know, what kind of fish you have. If you have a schooling fish, and they'll be perfectly happy to be together in a bag. If you have betas, for example, you don't want to necessarily do that.
Throw them all together in a bucket.
Or you can even, if you have a cooler that hasn't had, you know, soap and detergents and gunk like that in it, or if it's been really, really thoroughly rinsed off, maybe with some baking soda or something like that, you could put them in a cooler with a few inches of water in the bottom.
Okay.
Of course, not with ice.
No.
But you could put them in a cooler. That's one good way to do it. Then in your tank, you drain off the rest of the water, get your water level as low as you can. Depending on how heavy your substrate layer is and so on, you might want to consider removing it. If there's just a thin layer of substrate, you could probably leave it in pretty safely. And maybe even leave a little bit of water in, depending on the size of the tank and so on. Like the tank I had, again, less than 5 gallons. I left about 3/4 of an inch of water at the bottom. And actually left African clawed frogs in there. The background of this tank, It's a tank that has...
We weren't going an hour, though.
No, we weren't. It's about 20 minutes. We had dividers in the tank. And it was a temporary home for the fish, so they're going to get bigger quarters when they're at work, the way they're going to be divvied up. So I had African frogs in there, and I had betas in different partitions of the tank.
Well, the betas weren't in there when we were moving the tank, though.
Right. We took them out and put them in jars first for the actual travel.
It's actually our beta baby's parents.
Yep, and Merlin.
And Merlin, the...
Almost parent.
Once in future parent.
Yeah, he may be a parent. You know, he built a bubble nest the other day.
Maybe he's getting a clue.
I wouldn't build a bubble nest for anything a few weeks ago, and now he built one. Actually, both the males built one the same day.
They're just, you know, being competitive.
Yeah. And then, then once you've removed your water level as much as you can, really, it's you don't want to leave much in there at all, because water's heavy, for one, and... can cause splashes and problems for others.
One, it can damage your tank. It can crack your tank if you're trying to move it with too much water in it.
Yeah,
right?
That's what I mean by the weight. It's heavy. Yeah. I mean, lifting it, of course, is one issue, but...
Oh, see, that's what I think of first.
Dangerous. Cracking the tank.
I don't pick that up. It weighs too much.
And if you have 3 inches of substrate in there, I mean, that's heavy.
That's heavy.
Too. But if it's a planted substrate and you've got plants in there, you need to leave a little water in there so they don't, you know... There are things to consider there. So, when we've talked about the clean tank water and some tap water ahead of time that's been outgassed and the temperature's been brought to the target temperature if possible. Of course, a lot of these are just if possibles, but get as close as you can to that.
Okay, and what else after the if possibles?
Okay, I really feel bad saying all these if possibles, because a lot of them you can't do. A lot of the time, you just can't do it. If you're moving really far away, I mean, there's no way you can have water prepared in the house and so on. But sometimes it's better to let the tank sit and outgas if you can't bring water with you. You know, you get water of the temperature as close as you can by mixing, you know, carefully warm water with cool water. Let it outgas for a few hours is better, and get the temperature closer, you know.
How do you know when it's done outgassing? I mean, is it making lots of bubbles and then it slows down? Or is there a visual cue that it's mostly done outgassing?
Well, there are lots of things that can help you understand how that works. But basically, if you see... The water typically goes in from the tap, goes in under pressure. And then after a few minutes of going into the tank, you'll notice bubbles all over everything, right? They will be there for a number of hours, and it does depend partly on the temperature, and it depends on how much, you know, there are a lot of factors that govern that. But within, I've usually noticed within a few hours after that initial outgassing, it's not going to happen as much. And if you have some good aeration and water movement going on during that time, it'll help speed up the outgassing, and so on. Ideally, 24 hours would be good. But when you're moving,
your fish can't always wait that long.
When you're moving, you can't always wait that long, but you try to do as best you can. That's why I advise doing, you know, getting the water outgassed first if you can. But you got to do what you got to do. And I've had fish in dire circumstances survive outgassing. which is bad. It's not a good thing, but, you know, sometimes it's a choice between death or maybe death.
Maybe death.
And then you choose maybe death. If it is one of those choices, you know, sometimes you got to make that choice. And the fish have done okay on the occasions, and I've lost fish. I think I've talked about a few years ago, I lost some cardinal tetras. Just they didn't have enough time, and it didn't work. Very bad. It's a tragedy. I love those cardinal tetras. They were great.
Sad. Is that thing. When we moved here?
It is. That was a number of years ago when I was very sad. I still regret that. Mm-hmm. Not being able to do anything better. We had so many tanks and so little time, and it just... I couldn't get everything. Those were the only fatalities.
Yeah.
The cardinal tetras. And everything else was okay, but that was just bad. So hopefully that gives some ideas. If you can, the ideal would be to set up the tank and monitor everything after you've outgassed and everything. Don't turn the heater on. Don't plug the heater in until it's sat in the water for an hour.
Why is that?
Because you can also crack it. Cause damage to the heater.
Just because it was dry before? Or
because it hasn't adjusted the temperature
of
yet,
the water
of
that
the
it's
water,
already
right?
in.
So don't plug it in immediately. Most heaters recommend an hour, half an hour of letting it sit there and adjust the temperature. And, of course, you want to get the temperature pretty close to your target temperature before you turn the heater on anyway so that it doesn't reach a temperature you didn't want.
I'm going to insert a little comment here that...
Okay.
Sort of a tangent.
Okay.
But... I was just thinking about how lovely it is that all these things that you have to do with the fish, wait 24 hours, wait an hour, wait this long, sit there and look at your fish for an hour. And it just, I don't know, it just struck me just now as that's part of why it's such a lovely hobby. It makes us slow down and relax and look at things and observe instead of this crazy world where everything's instant and you have to send everything instantly and you expect everything instantly and nobody wants to wait for anything. And this is... No, we're going to make you wait for it. You have to wait for it if you want it to work.
Part of the zen of fish keeping.
Yes, yes, okay.
No, that's a good point. I'm glad you brought that up. I think it's true. You can't hurry certain natural processes, mm-hmm. and you shouldn't.
Yeah.
It's a good point. And...
There should be no fish tank.
Right. Yeah, none of those really work. They make them. But those screensavers...
They have, like, apps or
and
something.
Stuff, they're just not the same. They're kind of cool, but they're not the same. Well, one thing I can say that in general, if you follow these guidelines as closely as you can, usually fish do pretty well. Like the fish I moved today, happy as clams within minutes. You know, all they, as far as they were concerned, it was a funny water change, and they spent a little while in a jar. But it worked out, and they're all happy. So hopefully your fish, Hendrika, will be just as happy. And please feel free to contact us if you'd like us to elaborate on any of those points. Or if you have specific questions that we didn't address.
So, again, thank you, Andrika. Good luck with your move.
Yes, we hope it goes well and without a hitch or a drip.
Or a drip, yes. Now, before we end, we have another message from Tony, who I failed to mention in his last message, specifically said that he was very much enjoying all the beta baby shows.
The in-depth coverage.
In-depth coverage,
so
he said,
we're glad
yes.
you enjoy it.
Thank you, Tony. And we have another good, long, interesting message from him about cleaning crews.
Yeah. Well, his message isn't so long. My response is long.
Okay. Well, but anyways, it would lead into a very nice, long discussion. And we don't want to rush it. So since we're almost out of time, we are going to save that for next week. So you'll have something to look forward to.
Yeah, it'll be cool. I kind of like talking about cleanup crews personally.
It's true, you do.
I once worked as a custodian.
That's probably why.
That's not the real reason.
No, I just, that is so the reason.
I like creatures that clean up my tank. Then I don't have to.
Well, you know what? If I had a creature that did the laundry for me, I would like it too.
I do the laundry for you.
I know, but you're not a creature.
I'm not?
No, you're a lovely human being that I like very much.
Okay, well... So, Tony, Carlos, Andrika, and the rest of you Aquarimaxers, thank you very much, and...
May the fish...
be with you.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Aquarimax Audio Show. For additional episodes, please visit aquarimax.com. For comments and or questions that may be featured on an upcoming podcast, leave a message at 801-477-0629 or email us at info@aquarimax.com.